Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Comments can be addressed to me at rhall@oregonstate.edu. My guest today is Benjamin Ross. He and a co-author, Stephen Amter, wrote the book, The Polluters, The Making of Our Chemically Altered Environment. Welcome.
Great to be here in Corvallis.
You gave a talk about the book and the findings in the book. We'll talk about some of those findings and the approach. One of the things I always like to ask people is just to find out a little bit about their background and how they got into this kind of work. And I heard you say that you're a hydrologist.
That's right. Actually, I studied physics in college and grad school, and then was looking for a job when I finished grad school and got a job in environmental modeling. And it was modeling of groundwater problems. We're looking at the movement of the pollutants in the water.
And so one thing led to another, and now you're president of a company, Disposal Safety. Tell me a little bit about the company.
It's a small consulting company. Myself and my co-author are the two professionals there.
So you do hydrological studies for, like, communities and cities?
Right.
How did you get interested in writing this book?
I've done writing in Descent magazine off and on for about the last 10 years.
Is that particularly related to environmental matters?
No. Steve and I together wrote one article there that turns into about half of one of the chapters in the book.
Oh.
But the other stuff I've written there has been on all sorts of topics. It's been around for more than 50 years. Irving Howe was the founder. The first time I wrote for them, he was still alive. And I have to say, the idea of sending something in that Irving Howe was going to copy edit gave me the real terrors as a writer.
Well, sometimes these people, though, are very nice.
Yes.
but they may be formidable also.
It was actually a very good experience, good terror, because it made me rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, which was a very good learning experience.
And so this book, which I think was published in 2010.
Yes, published last September.
And what led you to put these ideas in this body of information that you'd been reading and researching together as a book?
Well, we had been doing research over 10, 12 years into the history of what was known about pollution. We started out with the history of groundwater pollution and then branched out into other forms of pollution. And at a certain point, we started seeing the same people, the same organizations, the same methods showing up in very different places. And when you put the whole story of a person or an organization together, it was clear you were going to understand what was going on a lot better than by looking at one event in isolation.
Mm-hmm. So kind of a political science approach, if you like, or a social science approach at looking at the organization and the institutions that are doing this stuff.
Well, that's right. Although it helped deal with the science, too, because usually when somebody makes an argument to defend something that's really not very defensible, usually there's some degree of scientific plausibility to their argument, and it's often very complicated to prove why it's wrong. But then you look at the same person making three different arguments, and when you see that the arguments are contradictory, they'll take one side of the issue on one chemical and take the exact opposite on another chemical, then you can tell much more easily that they're not just honestly deluded. A good example of that is Paul Dean, who was a doctor at Public Health Service. He did a study that recommended increasing how much lead and arsenic people can take in the late 30s. He said that we will determine how much you can eat by looking at people who are breathing lead and arsenic, and we'll see how much lead and arsenic it takes to get you sick from breathing it, and then from that we'll calculate how much you can eat safely. Well, whether that's a defensible thing to do is a question that scientists still argue about today, and they certainly knew less about that 60 years ago. However, 2 years later, Dr. Neal was the person who said DDT is safe to use as a spray after objections were raised. Mm-hmm. And the people who raised the objections at the Food and Drug Administration and NIH had done experiments where they fed DDT to animals and the animals got sick.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Neal did breathing experiments, and he said, well, you can ignore all those ingestion experiments because of my breathing experiments.
Uh-huh.
And
Just the opposite.
But either one of them, if you look at it in isolation, this isn't my field, but as I understand it, that's still something that people argue about, how you relate whether something's safe to eat to whether it's safe to breathe. So either one of these arguments that he made standing on its own would have some scientific plausibility, leaving aside, certainly in the lead and arsenic case, there were other things wrong with what he did. But that part of it was plausible either time, but when you look at both.
I see what you mean. Seeing how a particular scientist or attorney or representative of a company interprets things over a number of different issues would help you find some problems with it. And your book here deals with material that's breathed, that's eaten, that's consumed, that lots of different avenues of pollution.
That's right. And it was interesting also to see how the chemical industry would develop certain approaches to dealing with water pollution and then bring them over into air pollution.
How does the history help you understand these things?
You know, we've learned a tremendous amount more science over 100 years, mm-hmm. but people and politics change much less.
Interesting point.
Often the processes and the mechanisms of dealing with these issues are easier to see when you look at it in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also when you're arguing about some issues, it really gives you a different insight on it to know that people have been making the same arguments for 100 years.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you contrasted in your talk was very interesting and I think very, very relevant today. And that was where you took the precautionary principle and then opposed it to the principle that rather than excluding from the environment anything that might be a problem, opposing that with, well, if there's some economic benefit from not regulating and an unknown environmentally positive or health benefit, then of course the economic outweighs.
But it's really illuminating to know that people have been arguing about this for 85 years.
Wow.
And one of the things that we found when we did some of our research was that the precautionary principle, which people often think of as something very new, mm-hmm. was stated very clearly by the famous scientist Lord Kelvin in 1903.
So that's more than 100 years of history right there. A scientist who came into it kind of in the dark.
Right. Well, everyone was in the dark.
Everyone was in the dark. So
yeah.
All the more.
Right. It's very useful. People often think that some established doctrine is what was naturally just accepted science and that people making the opposite argument are, you know, upstarts that are questioning received truth.
Mm.
And when you look into the past, you often find that the received truth was originally not a received truth at all, and that there was a stiff argument over the very same things that mm-hmm. you think you're just arguing about now.
Mm-hmm. But there was some benefit to the opposition to regulation. The opposition to that idea has been around for a long time. Do you ever feel that those individuals are getting smarter or learning how to skirt around the boundaries of the law and sneak in their desires? Yeah, and it's usually an economic desire, I believe.
Well, I think there's no question that the methods used to distort science mm-hmm. have gotten more sophisticated. But at the same time, I think that today we have a great deal more ability to get at the truth. I think the internet makes a big difference mm-hmm. in this, because in the days when a report would be published and be in only 5 big university libraries and a few government agencies, mm-hmm. it was very hard for anyone to question it. You saw the newspaper article where they said everything's okay, but unless you were in the right city and had a day to go to the right library, mm-hmm. you couldn't even look at whether the report backed it up.
Right.
Now with the internet, that's completely different. Mm-hmm. You can look up the underlying report wherever you are very easily. You know, very often someone will announce, you know, we've done a study, it proves there's no problem.
Right.
And then when you actually read the study, it doesn't really prove that.
No.
And doesn't even say that. And I think that sort of thing is a lot harder to get away with today with the internet than it used to be.
Definitely ought to be much, much harder.
People have cleanup techniques, new cleanup technology. And, you know, they're always telling you how it's a success because they want to sell it. This, by the way, is an area where there's equal concern from the representative industry and the environmentalists, because I've talked with people in industry who will be happy to tell you that they are plagued with salesmen who claim to have the miracle cleanup technology for all their problems.
Interesting, yeah. Well, you follow a lot of threads in your book, and one of them is very strongly agricultural. Today, you talked about the apple growers in central Washington. Well, tell me a little bit about the beginning of that, because that's almost a local issue here, and certainly Washington State is very well known for their apples.
Right. This was the story that actually was kind of the piece of the jigsaw puzzle that made everything stick together. In the 1920s, they started using lead arsenate as a pesticide on apples. And Lord Kelvin, as we mentioned, the great scientist, had set a standard that was adopted in England and in Europe of allowing one part per million of arsenic in any food. People in England got sick from eating American apples, and the British government threatened to cut off all fruit imports from the United States unless the U.S. government would enforce this arsenic limit set by Lord Kelvin. But the apple growers in Wenatchee and the Yakima Valley didn't like this, and they fought back in court. At that time, the FDA could seize unwholesome food, but it couldn't set any standard.
So that means it would have to have done a test on that particular group of apples in this case, or whatever, in order to condemn it.
Right. What they did was they would test the apples for arsenic, and if it had too much, they would seize it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the farmers could go to court and challenge the science, say that amount of arsenic isn't dangerous. And the FDA had a problem, which was Lord Kelvin had data on how much arsenic eaten quickly will make you sick. He was the chairman of a commission that was formed after 70 people in England were killed by arsenic poisoning from beer. But the FDA didn't know what the effects were of eating low levels of arsenic all your life.
How cumulative it was.
Right. So they started an experiment. The chairman of the House Agricultural Appropriations Subcommittee, who was an apple farmer, didn't like this. So he put something in the law that made them stop the experiment. They had to slaughter 5,000 rats in the middle of the experiment.
Oh, boy, because they had started them and they couldn't use them.
Then the subcommittee chairman gave the money to another scientist who had done a study saying lead gasoline is safe and had prevented publication of a report on black lung disease and delayed the recognition of black lung disease for many years. And he designed a study that led to a doubling and tripling of the allowable human intake of lead and arsenic.
I'm sure some of the documents, when you're reading historic documents, don't really tell you why, do they?
No, they don't. But we have a hint in that he bought a series of very large houses on his government salary.
Oh, boy.
He wound up, when he retired from the government, buying a 1740 plantation house on a 230-acre estate from Andrew Mellon's ex-son-in-law just a few months after he retired from the government.
It sounds very much like a modern process.
Yeah, when I went all the way back and looked at Lord Kelvin's report from 1903, it was really interesting how modern a lot of it sounded, but not the beginning. The first page started off, "Because Your Majesty has most graciously granted us leave to report, we are sending this report."
Sometimes people thank the committee for allowing them to talk at a hearing, I suppose, but they're more flowery, aren't they?
That's right.
The U.S. seems to be lagging. It seems to be less sensitive than many of the European countries in paying attention to what is in our food. Am I wrong on that?
I don't think so, at least in Northern Europe. I don't follow the food research as much, but the area that I have worked on is drugs and groundwater. I was co-author of a paper 15 years ago where we discovered pentobarbital and a tranquilizer in somebody's water well. We sort of came across it by accident, and we published a paper about it. And for about 7 or 8 years, no one in this country would pay much attention to that issue. And the research was done overwhelmingly in Europe, mostly in Germany, on that particular issue. I find that in my area, typically in this country, there's much, much more funding to figure out ways to solve known problems than there is to find new problems. I think the problem is just that the U.S. just doesn't have funding for looking at new problems. I don't think that this got to the point where the drug companies would have to block anything in this country until it really grew in Britain, and then it was too late to keep quiet. I mean, now there are conferences on drugs and water, surface and groundwater.
So is the issue that it should be then the local water district, like in our case, City Corvallis, to check to see what's in that water?
I'm not sure what the best solution is because a lot of these things affect you at very low concentrations. I mean, that's why they're drugs.
Right.
The testing can be extremely expensive if you don't know what you're looking for, if you just want to see if anything is there. I don't know, as a policy question, what the best solution is. The U.S. Geological Survey did a big national survey where they collected a lot of samples and analyzed them for drugs. I think this is a case where the most important thing is prevention.
Absolutely.
Because the cost of analyzing for every drug in every city's drinking water would be prohibitive. You know, if you think about sewage, we don't analyze drinking water for every kind of microbe that can make you sick. We only analyze for one, which is E. coli. You know, what they call coliform bacteria. And many coliform bacteria don't make you sick. The idea is that if you see coliform bacteria in your drinking water, you know that sewage is getting into the drinking water, so you shouldn't be drinking it.
Right. And so you look for that source.
You look for that as a signal rather than looking for the things that would actually make you sick.
And if you find that sewage is getting in, then you want to find out where that's happening.
Until you stop it, you don't drink the water. And I think with the drugs, you probably need some similar sort of approach, because to really analyze for every possible drug on a regular basis in every city's drinking water would be a horrendous job.
Yeah. So the educational process between, the physician, the patient, and the pharmacy.
Yeah.
Educating individuals not to do that and not to dispose of any materials in that way.
Well, it's not so simple, because some of these drugs get into the sewage by being excreted after you use them.
Oh, sure. That's right. Absolutely.
It's not a simple problem.
No.
But it's an important one.
And then we've had a lot of interest in removing bisphenol A in Oregon.
Bisphenol A is, for a groundwater scientist, very tricky substance, because you see it, you detect it quite a bit, but you never know whether it's really in the sample or whether it's coming out of the plastic tubing that you're using to collect your sample.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
So it's very hard to get reliable data on bisphenol A in groundwater.
Can other kinds of materials be used to take samples, like copper pipes or something, or is that not?
Well, you need flexible tubing usually.
Oh, you need flexible. Yeah. Plastic is a wonderfully useful thing. There's no doubt about it.
The kind of data that we're usually working with are people that were looking for something else, and we're looking for what else they turned up. You have no way of knowing whether it's real or just sampling equipment, and phthalates are the same way.
Phthalates, yeah. And these things are in so many household products.
Well, I shouldn't say you have no way of knowing. If this stuff is showing up, you collect background samples, which are just clean water that you pass through your equipment.
Oh, the same equipment.
Through the same equipment.
Right.
If it shows up there, then you know it's not real. With plastic stuff, will the dirty water leach stuff out of the plastic more than the clean water? It's tricky.
Right.
It's tricky. You know, sometimes you know, but you have to be very careful.
So again, the prevention aspect might be the way to go. Well, I thought it might be nice just to talk about each of the chapters very briefly to show the range of subjects in The Polluters. We're talking now to co-author Benjamin Ross.
Okay. After an introduction, the first chapter talks about the initial years of pollution control in the federal government before it was really focused on the chemical industry under Teddy Roosevelt and that period. Then we have a chapter that gives background on the chemical industry, both how it grew in terms of synthetic chemicals in this country. It was very tied in with the First World War, provisions of the Versailles Treaty, and the tremendous political influence that the chemical industry came to have in the 1930s.
How does the Versailles Treaty come into it? I'm just curious.
Germany was by far the world leader in synthetic chemicals before the First World War. During the First World War, the governments of the Allied powers seized the rights to the German patents and allowed their own chemical companies to make the things that the Germans had patented.
Was that partly because of use in warfare?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And also they had a lot of other uses that were very important. And you could no longer buy the things from Germany, and you were at war with them, so you weren't going to pay royalties to Germany.
Right.
You know, in Britain and France, they were already making a lot of these compounds and paying royalties to the Germans. And the government wasn't going to keep paying royalties to the Germans when they were fighting a war with them.
Right.
One of the reparations in the Versailles Treaty was that the Allied powers got to keep the German patents. The Attorney General Mitchell Palmer appointed his friend Francis Garvin as the custodian of enemy property. Francis Garvin sold all of the German chemical patents for $250,000 to a foundation that had been set up under the control of the American chemical companies. And then he left the government and became president of this foundation for the rest of his life.
Wow. And of course, many historians feel that the Second World War was somewhat predicated on the Versailles Treaty. So go ahead to another chapter.
The next chapter is about chemicals in workplaces and in consumer products, and how the first issues came up about those, and that led the chemical industry and other industries to set up some of the institutions that they later used to fight off environmental regulation.
Develop a strategy which worked in one case, so let's use it elsewhere.
That's right. Then we get into the sort of middle part of the book, and we deal with different environmental issues more or less in sequence. First, pesticides. Then there's a chapter on environmental cancer. Then we have two chapters on air pollution, one focusing on Los Angeles and the other on a disaster in Denora, Pennsylvania in 1948 that killed 20 people. Then we have two chapters on water pollution, one on federal regulation and one on state regulation. And then we have a chapter on chlorinated solvents, which are very important groundwater pollutants.
And the chlorinated solvents, what would they come from? What would be the source for them being in the groundwater?
Well, they're spilled and dumped. Used mostly for metal degreasing. That's the biggest use.
So it could be garages? Automobile garages, or is that small
Yeah,
potatoes?
It could be, but that's small potatoes. Okay. A big aircraft plant.
Oh, right.
Okay, then the last few chapters deal with the reaction. We have a chapter that deals with DuPont specifically.
Oh, yeah.
And their cleanup efforts. They also get big billing in the earlier chapter about political influence. The DuPonts, for example, the DuPont family and its close colleagues by themselves paid 7% of the entire Republican campaign in the 1936 election.
Oh, wow. Way back then, even.
Yeah. Then we have a chapter on the industry as a whole and how they were responding to this problem. And these two chapters are very interesting because we've got a lot of documents showing the people within the industry who were trying to clean things up. And they had some successes, and they had a lot of failures, too.
And hard times on themselves as individuals as well?
Oh, no. These people...
They were working, but they weren't able to make it happen.
Right. The industry, when they had a problem that they decided to clean up, they would hire the best engineers they could find. And some of these very good people did good work, a lot of people.
And sometimes it really worked, and sometimes it didn't.
Right. Sometimes they got frustrated with their own companies because the companies weren't willing to spend the money.
Okay. That was kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah. All of it. Then we have a somewhat longer chapter that takes the story all the way up to Love Canal in 1980. And the book concludes with a fascinating speech given by the vice president of a chemical company to the Southern Industrial Wastes Conference in Houston in 1954, in which this chemical company vice president gives a strong warning about global warming.
Good for him.
And just issues a challenge to the whole industry that, you know, still is a very good statement of the problem today. What was interesting was that the people who attended this committee mostly were the hands-on cleanup people within the chemical companies. And we have evidence where they were pushing their management to come hear this message.
But it takes a lot of pushing, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, as the chief water pollution engineer at Dow Chemical said in the early 50s in one of these discussions, we have to tell management that if they don't clean up themselves, the government will make them do it. Prophetic.
And the government will diddle and dawdle, but maybe it'll get there. And we hope it will.
Yeah. Well, I do believe that there was a fundamental change happening in the 1970s. And while we often get frustrated with the problems of EPA, its slowness, its bureaucracy, its unwillingness to deal with new problems, it is still clear that there was a fundamental change in the 1970s, and we have not gone back to the situation before then. I believe the cause of that essentially is that there is far more public concern and public pressure.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Benjamin Ross.
Been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording in Corvallis, Oregon. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers in Kent White.